Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 370, titled Dutch Treat, More on the Bush, Thiessen, Netherlands Financial Connection. This is being recorded on July 29th of the year 2001. We're going to begin by taking a look briefly at an article which touches on one of the elements of inquiry that we've been looking at considerable length, namely the Bank Altaqua. Now, one of the things that we're going to be focusing on heavily in this broadcast concerns the Thiessen, Bornemisza, Lugano, Switzerland connection, and we're going to be taking a look at a couple of articles from John Loftus's website that further delineate the relationship between Dutch capital and German capital and the genesis of the Bush family fortune. In turn, at least geographically, and in turn in terms of some intersections between the milieu of Altaqua and the milieu of the Third Reich. As an interrogatory note, we're going to be asking about the possibility that perhaps some of the elements on the American side in September 11th, and also some of the elements involved with the Wahhabi / Middle Eastern connections might actually be branches of what I call the Underground Reich, and specifically its economic element that was in turn had its genesis in terms of its post-war situation with the Bormann Flight Capital Program that was established during the closing days of World War II. Now, again, Lugano, Switzerland is the epicenter of Altaqua. It also is the epicenter of the Thiessen Bornemisza branch of the, well, the post-war Underground Reich, which in turn constitutes a major element of liaison between the Dutch-related elements of the Thiessen Empire and those branches of the Thiessen economic empire that overlapped the Harriman 15 and the fortune of the Bush family. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, July 23rd of the year 2002, on an article, or on a page, I should say, that had a number of different articles dealing with the events in and around September 11th. There was a column from the Chronicle News Services or Chronicle Wire Services pages that was called Other Developments, and in a subheading called Terror Groups, we find the following. Attorney General John Ashcroft asked the State Department on Monday to list 9 foreign groups and companies as terrorist organizations. The listing would prohibit any non-citizen members from entering the United States. Under a broad anti-terrorism law President Bush signed last year, groups that finance or supported terrorists can be listed as terrorist organizations. The State Department has final authority over which groups are included on the list. The list, which already includes 39 groups, is aimed specifically at keeping group members from entering the country. The government has another list of alleged terrorist groups whose assets it has sought to freeze. The groups proposed for by Ashcroft for listing, and then there are a number of different organizations, but of particular interest for us here exploring the Lugano-Switzerland connection, the organizations of note are Altaqua Trade Property and Industry Company Limited, Bank Altaqua Limited, Nada Management Organization, and Youssef M. Nada and Company Gesellschaft. Those four organizations, again, Altaqua Trade and Property Industry Company Limited, Bank Altaqua, Nada Management Organization, and Youssef M. Nada and Company Gesellschaft, constitute some of the branches of the Altaqua / Nada Management Complex, which in turn overlaps the Banco del Gottardo in Lugano, Switzerland, and with a major branch of the milieu of September 11th and its support organizations running through Lugano, Switzerland, and with a number of evidentiary tributaries in turn running from Altaqua / Nada Management back in the direction of the Third Reich, and with the Thiessen Bornemisza branch of the Thiessen operations in turn connected to the post-war Bormann milieu also running through Lugano, Switzerland. Once again, we're going to be asking the question to what extent there may be a Third Reich / Underground Reich connection between the Thiessen Bornemisza operations in Lugano, those of Altaqua / Nada Management in that same city, and in turn the financial underpinnings of the Bush family here in the United States. We're going to review briefly in terms of refreshing ourselves vis-a-vis Bank Altaqua, et cetera. I've talked about Altaqua in numerous programs, including, for the record, 335, number 342, 343, 352, 354, and 356 through 359. In the book Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam, published in softcover by the Algora Press and authored by Richard LaBeviere, we find the following about Altaqua, again cited by the Justice Department and John Ashcroft as among the list of individuals and institutions supportive of terrorism. Its Lugano connection is reviewed in Dollars for Terror as follows. While establishing its headquarters in a tax haven, that's Nassau, the Bahamas, the Brothers, that's the Muslim Brotherhood's Bank, opened a branch, Altaqua Management Organization S.A., in Italian Switzerland, in Lugano. Lugano, a discreet frontier banking locale near Italy, is a stone's throw from Milan, a major financial center, and, above all, the Islamist group's entry point to Europe. Altaqua is situated on the top floor of a small glass building right in the center of Lugano, in the banking district, a district where overly curious journalists are immediately denounced to the police, who then conduct American-style identity checks in the middle of the street. In Lugano, bank secrecy is no laughing matter. Several times we tried to meet Mr. Natta, who eventually responded by mail, quote, "We allow neither you nor any other journalist nor publication to speak about us positively or negatively without our written permission," unquote, signed Youssef Natta. This book, by the way, was published in French in 1999 and then republished in English by Algora, copyright 2000. Skipping down of Youssef Natta's historical membership in the Muslim Brotherhood and his work in World War II, allegedly on behalf of Third Reich Intelligence and Admiral Wilhelm Canaris of the Abwehr, we read, "But Youssef Natta is even better known to the Egyptian services, who have evidence of his membership in the armed branch of the fraternity of the Muslim Brothers in the 1940s. At that time, according to the same sources, he was working for the Abwehr under Admiral Canaris and took part in a plot against King Farouk of Egypt. This was not the first time that the path of the Muslim Brothers crossed that of the servants of the Third Reich. The founder of the fraternity himself, Hassan al-Banna, served as an intermediary between those who went on to become the free officers, in particular Anwar al-Sadat, and the agents of Nazi Germany." By the way, Hassan al-Banna was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and as we looked at in For the Record 369, among other programs, as well as number 359, he was listed as a member of the board of directors of Altaqua in Lugano, Switzerland. More about Lugano, Switzerland, and this again is by way of review. We've looked at considerable length and over the years at the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning, part of Edward R. Murrow's team covering the war in Europe, World War II, that is, for the CBS radio network. Manning then trained as a gunner aboard B-17s in order to fly combat missions and cover those journalistically over Europe and World War II, broadcast the surrender of Nazi Germany on the CBS radio network, then trained as a gunner aboard B-29s to cover the air raids over Japan, and then broadcast the surrender of Japan over the CBS radio network as well. His book about the post-war Nazi money machine was called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981 by the Manning family. And of Heinrich Thiessen Bornemisza, about whom we're going to say more here in just a minute, and his use of Lugano, Switzerland as the epicenter for his Dutch-based investment group, we read, "Heinrich Thiessen Bornemisza runs his private Dutch-based investment group from Lugano, Switzerland, and his cousin, Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, grandson of old Fritz Thiessen, exercises control over Thiessen AG from his base in Buenos Aires." So the two main post-war branches of the Thiessen industrial empire, in turn in exile, were based in Buenos Aires, in the case of the Zichy Thiessen interests, and in Lugano, Switzerland, in connection with the Heinrich Thiessen Bornemisza interests, about whom we're going to say more here in just a minute. I would note that in For the Record program number 358, we took a look at the fact that it was in the middle of April when the investigation into Lugano, the Banco del Gottardo, the Nada Management / Altaqua Milia. It was when that was in full swing that Heinrich Thyssen-Born Misa passed away, allegedly after a series of strokes. I'm not saying necessarily that there was anything suspicious about the timing of his death, but it certainly was interesting, and one wonders whether perhaps one of the Die Alte Kameraden, so to speak, was being retired for purposes of operational convenience. Again, that is pure speculation. What we're going to look at next concerns the role of the Dutch branch of this industrial empire, specifically the Dutch investments that went to the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart, which was established by old August Thyssen prior to World War I in order to mask his assets from the site of Allied investigators who were seeking basically compensation for German crimes committed in World War I. It was in order to shield German assets in World War I that old August Thyssen, again the last name capital T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, set up the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart, which was at that time in neutral Holland. We're going to hear about the Dutch connections to post-war Thyssen Empire. Now, note in particular here, the Union Banking Corporation, that is a joint Thyssen-Bush family operation, which in turn was conducted under the auspices of the Harriman Banking Empire, and specifically Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell helped to mask the Bush family holdings on behalf of the Third Reich in the Harriman 15. Those holdings included the Union Banking Corporation, the post-war liquidation of which went on to provide the foundation for the elder George Bush's post-war business interests, and also the Hamburg America line that we've looked at in connection with the Bush family and in connection with the Bormann Flight Capital Program in the past, and also an institution that we're going to be examining at some length in the second half of the program, namely the Silesian American Corporation, which was not only involved with the Bush family connections to the Third Reich, but which also had a direct connection to the slave labor camps that were set up at Auschwitz to work, among other facilities, the Silesian American interests, which at that point had been folded into other interests, other Third Reich business interests as well. Now, take note of several things. First of all, note that the post-war Thyssen operations, and that became a key element of the Nazi flight capital program and a key element of what I call the Underground Reich, the post-war Thyssen operations were largely centered through the pivot point of, or in the pivot point of, the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart. So the Dutch connections here, the Dutch treat, so to speak, for the Bush family, that is inextricably linked with the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart, which was in many ways sort of the pivot point for the post-World War II Thyssen interests. Note also that a Dutch journalist who was investigating this in 1996 dropped dead under some very strange circumstances. Note also that the Dutch manager of the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart, who traveled to New York City in order to demand an honest answer on behalf of his bank's role as a proxy for the Third Reich, he turned up dead in New York City 2 weeks after traveling there in order to help get things straightened out. He was apparently less than wholly successful in his efforts. First article we're going to be looking at, and in particular the post-World War, the immediate post-war death of the manager of the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart in New York, and the 1996 death of a Dutch journalist named Eddie Rover, who was investigating the post-war connections. Again, this was in 1996, is worth noting here. 1996 is a long way after the formal conclusion of World War II, and some of the post-war interests here are the central element in our inquiry. This article is called How the Bush Family Made Its Fortune from the Nazis. This is posted on John Loftus's website at www.johnloftus.com/thyssen.htm. That's lowercase J-O-H-N hyphen L-O-F-T-U-S .com/ then capital T in thyssen.htm. This article, in turn, was previously posted on a website by Robert Lederman, a writer out of Philadelphia. This article is titled, again, How the Bush Family Made Its Fortune from the Nazis. And it's by John Loftus, but posted on, initially anyway, Robert Letterman's website. And there it contains the following note. This article's author, John Loftus, is a former U.S. Department of Justice Nazi war crimes prosecutor, the president of the Florida Holocaust Museum, and the highly respected author of numerous books on the CIA Nazi connection, including The Belarus Secret and The Secret War Against the Jews, both of which have extensive material on the Bush-Rockefeller-Nazi connection. And this article is, the initial subtitle is The Dutch Connection. Subtitled, again, How a Famous American Family Made Its Fortune from the Nazis. For the Bush family, it is a lingering nightmare. And the article begins, actually. For their Nazi clients, the Dutch connection was the mother of all money laundering schemes. From 1945, actually let me begin again, How a Famous American Family Made Its Fortune from the Nazis for the Bush family. For the Bush family, it is a lingering nightmare. That's the actual start of the article here. For the Bush family, it is a lingering nightmare. For their Nazi clients, the Dutch connection was the mother of all money laundering schemes. From 1945 until 1949, one of the lengthiest and, it now appears, most futile interrogations of a Nazi war crime suspect began in the American zone of occupied Germany. Multi-billionaire steel magnate Fritz Thyssen, the man whose steel combine was the cold heart of the Nazi war machine, talked and talked and talked to a joint U.S.-UK interrogation team. For four long years, successive teams of inquisitors tried to break Thyssen's simple claim to possess neither foreign bank accounts nor interests in foreign corporations, no assets that might lead to the missing billions in assets of the Third Reich. The inquisitors failed utterly. Why? Because what the wily Thyssen deposed was, in a sense, true. What the Allied investigators never understood was that they were not asking Thyssen the right question. Now, there are several generations of Thyssens here. First of all, old August Thyssen was a German steel magnate who set up the bank for Handel and Schäfer in order to mask his assets from inquisitive Allies in World War I. Then his son, Fritz Thyssen, became one of the earliest financial backers for Adolf Hitler. He also, in that context, formed business relationships in 1924 through the Bank für Handel und Schifffahrt with the Bush family, the initial contact there, the initial investment being the Union Banking Corporation. Then, in turn, old Fritz Thyssen had two sons, Count Federico Zichy Thyssen and Baron Heinrich Thyssen Bornemisza, and it is the Thyssen Bornemisza / Bush / Bank für Handel und Schifffahrt connection, the Dutch treat of the Thyssen Bush connection, that we're going to be looking at here. And again, it is the Thyssen Bornemisza branch of the Thyssen Empire that goes through Lugano, Switzerland. That is the epicenter as well for Nada Management / Alpaqua. Turning once again to John Loftus's article. What the Allied investigators never understood was that they were not asking Thyssen the right question. Thyssen did not need any foreign bank accounts because his family secretly owned an entire chain of banks. He did not have to transfer his Nazi assets at the end of World War II. All he had to do was transfer the ownership documents, stocks, bonds, deeds, and trusts from his bank in Berlin through his bank in Holland to his American friends in New York City, Prescott Bush Sr. and Herbert Walker. Thyssen's partners in crime were the father and father-in-law of a future president of the United States. The Allied investigators underestimated Thyssen's reach, his connections, his motives, and his means. The web of financial entities Thyssen helped create in the 1920s remained a mystery for the rest of the century, an almost perfectly hidden underground sewer pipeline for moving dirty money, money that bankrolled the post-war fortunes not only of the Thyssen Industrial Empire, but the Bush family as well. It was a secret Fritz Thyssen would take to his grave. Next, John Loftus goes into the connections of William Gowan, an intelligence agent whose father had been one of President Roosevelt's, Franklin Roosevelt's emissaries to the Vatican, and it was indeed through the investigative efforts of the junior William Gowan, a former U.S. intelligence agent, that much of the Dutch treat connections to the Thyssen, Bornemisza, and Bush families came to light. John Loftus describes this. It was a secret that would lead former U.S. intelligence agent William Gowan, now pushing 80, to the very doorstep of the Dutch royal family. The Gowans are no strangers to controversy or to nobility. His father was one of President Roosevelt's diplomatic emissaries to Pope Pius XII, leading a futile attempt to persuade the Vatican to denounce Hitler's treatment of the Jews. It was his son, William Gowan, who served in Rome after World War II as a Nazi hunter and investigator with the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps. It was Agent Gowan who first discovered the secret Vatican rat line for smuggling Nazis in 1949. It was also the same William Gowan who began to uncover the secret Dutch pipeline for smuggling Nazi money in 1999. A half century earlier, Fritz Thiessen was telling the Allied investigators that he had no interest in foreign companies, that Hitler had turned on him and seized most of his property. His remaining assets were mostly in the Russian-occupied zone of Germany, which he knew were a write-off anyway. His distant and allegedly disliked relatives in neutral nations like Holland were the actual owners of a substantial percentage of the remaining German industrial base. As, quote, innocent victims of the Third Reich, unquote, they were lobbying the Allied occupation governments in Germany, demanding restitution of the property that had been seized from them by the Nazis. Under the rules of the Allied occupation of Germany, all property owned by citizens of a neutral nation which had been seized by the Nazis had to be returned to the neutral citizens upon proper presentation of documents showing proof of ownership. Suddenly, all sorts of neutral parties, particularly in Holland, were claiming ownership of various pieces of the Thiessen Empire. In his cell, Fritz Thiessen just smiled and waited to be released from prison while members of the Dutch royal family and the Dutch intelligence service reassembled his pre-war holdings for him. The British, and by the way, we're going to hear about some of the interesting connections of the Dutch royal family in just a second. The British and American interrogators may have gravely underestimated Thiessen, but they nonetheless knew that they were being lied to. Their suspicions focused on one Dutch bank in particular, the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart in Rotterdam. This bank did a lot of business with the Thiessens over the years. In 1923, as a favor to him, the Rotterdam Bank loaned the money to build the very first Nazi Party headquarters in Munich. But somehow, the Allied investigators kept going nowhere. The intelligence leads all seemed to dry up. If the investigators realized that the U.S. intelligence chief in post-war Germany, Alan Dulles, was also the Rotterdam Bank's lawyer, they might have asked some very interesting questions. They did not know that Thiessen was Dulles' client as well, nor did they ever realize that it was Alan Dulles' other client, Baron Kurt von Schroeder, who was the Nazi trustee for the Thiessen companies which now claimed to be owned by the Dutch. The Rotterdam Bank was at the heart of Dulles' cloaking scheme, and he guarded its secrets jealously. Several decades after the war, investigative reporter Paul Manning, Edward R. Murrow's colleague, stumbled across the Thiessen interrogations in the U.S. National Archives. Manning intended to write a book about Nazi money laundering. Manning's manuscript, in turn, was a dagger aimed at Alan Dulles' throat. His book specifically mentioned the Bank voor Handel en Scheepvaart by name, albeit in passing. Then John Loftus goes on to put some distance between himself and the notion that Martin Bormann survived World War II. It should be borne in mind in this context that John Loftus is a former prosecuting attorney, and that's characteristic of the methodology of a prosecutor. The whole issue of Martin Bormann's survival and his post-war activities is a very controversial one, and a number of writers have been discredited by pursuing that particular connection. It is not something that Manning particularly wants to get hung up on. He notes that Alan Dulles was tapped by Paul Manning in order to help steer him in the right direction, and that Dulles in turn basically pointed Paul Manning in some of the wrong directions. I would note that it was the disclosures of the Paul Manning in his book that in turn dovetail with the information presented here by John Loftus and in turn by William Gowan and another set of U.S. interrogators. Indeed, it was the Bank für Handel und Schifffahrt, which is mentioned here by Paul Manning, that ultimately dovetailed with what John Loftus is pointing out here as well. With regard to Martin Bormann's post-war survival, one of the more compelling documents is also presented here in passing by Paul Manning, and I will simply leave the whole issue of Bormann to the Paul Manning text. Among the many documentary sources drawn upon by Paul Manning was the FBI file on Martin Bormann, which is excerpted here as follows in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. When the file, now in my possession, was received at FBI headquarters, it revealed that the Reichsleiter had indeed been tracked for years. One report covered his whereabouts from 1948 to 1961 in Argentina, Paraguay, Brazil, and Chile. The file revealed that he had been banking, Bormann that is, under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National City Bank, Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. So I'll simply leave that to speak for itself concerning Bormann's post-war career. I would note the Chase Manhattan Bank is front and center in the discussion of the post-war masking of the Thiessen assets that we're talking about here. The various programs that I've done over the years are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, capital S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. The Spitfire website is equipped with real audio, and the two most recent pairs of half-hour segments are available on a weekly basis. And please note that there are detailed annotated descriptions of each For the Record program that are posted on the Spitfire website, usually right about at the same time that the real audio segments go up, or within a few days, so that people that find it easier to read the material can do so on the Spitfire website. In addition, sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming on Real Audio at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emory, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. There is a link between the For the Record segment, or there was a link in the For the Record segment, and in each description of the programs about September 11th and after that, to the WFMU website, and also to another longer WFMU URL, which has older For the Record programs streaming, or available for download only on Real Audio. So again, in the For the Record section of the Spitfire websites, there are not only detailed, annotated descriptions of the various programs that are available, and in particular on September 11th, but that there are links to two Real Audio sites maintained by sister station WFMU. WFMU.org/Dave Emery has more recent programs streaming. There's a longer URL also linked to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the other WFMU URL that has older For the Record broadcasts available for download only. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 370, Dutch Treat, more on the Thiessen-Bush money connection. This is being recorded on July 29th of the year 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.